something like relief on his face. But he glanced toward Falcon, watching all from his seat.
They are things that should be told privately, Edge. Not rude, but certainly not warm.
Nezrin refrained from echoing the prince's sentiment.
Hulan waved a hand.
Then they may wait. She pointed to the stone bench. Sit.
Edge.
Falcon shifted, as if he'd do them all a favor and go. But Hulan pointed to him in silent warning to remain.
I would have you all listen.
Sartak dropped onto the bench, the only sign of his discontent being the foot he tapped on the floor. Nezrin sat beside him, the stern woman reclaiming her perch between them and Falcon.
An ancient malice is stirring deep in these mountains, Hulan said.
It is why I have been gone these past few days, to seek it out.
Edge, warning and fear coated the prince's voice.
I am not so old that I cannot wield my Sulde, boy. She glowered at him. Indeed, nothing about this woman seemed old at all. Sartak asked, frowning,
What did you go in pursuit of?
Hulan glanced around the hall for any stray ears.
Rook nests have been pillaged.
Eggs stolen in the night. Hatchlings vanishing. Sartak swore, filthy and low. Nezrin blinked at it, even as her stomach tightened.
Poachers have not dared tread in these mountains for decades, the prince said.
But you should not have pursued them alone, Edge.
It was not poachers I sought, but something worse.
Shadows lined the woman's face, and Nezrin swallowed.
If the Volg had come here, my own Edge called them the Karen Kui.
It means shadow, darkness, Sartak murmured to Nezrin, dread tightening his face.
Her heart thundered. Should the Volg be here already?
But in your lands, Hulan went on, glancing between Nezrin and Falcon.
They call them something different, don't they?
Nezrin sized up Falcon as he swallowed, wondering herself how to lie or deflect revealing anything about the Volg. But Falcon nodded, and he replied, voice barely audible above the flame.
We call them the Stygian Spiders.
Chapter 31
The Stygian Spiders are little more than myths, Nezrin managed to say to Hulan. Spider silk is so rare, some even doubt it exists. You might be chasing ghosts. But it was Falcon who replied with a grim smile.
I would beg to differ, Captain Felique.
He reached into the breast of his jacket, and Nezrin tensed, hand shooting for the dagger at her waist. It was no weapon he pulled out. The white fabric glittered, the iridescence like starfire, as Falcon shifted it in his hand. Even Sartak whistled at the handkerchief-sized piece of cloth.
Spider silk,
Falcon said, tucking the piece back into his jacket.
Straight from the source.
As Nezrin's mouth popped open, Sartak said, You have seen these terrors up close. Not quite a question.
I bartered with their kin in the northern continent,
Falcon corrected. That grim smile remaining, along with shadows.
So many shadows. Nearly 3 years ago. Some might deem it a fool's bargain, but I walked away with 100 yards of spider silk.
The handkerchief in his jacket alone could fetch a king's ransom.
100 yards of it?
You must be wealthy as the Khagan, she blurted.
A shrug. I have learned that true wealth is not all glittering gold and jewels.
Sartak asked quietly.
What was the cost, then?
For the Stygian spiders traded not in material goods, but dreams and wishes and...
20 years.
20 years of my life. Taken not from the end, but the prime. Nezrin scanned the man, his face just beginning to show the signs of age,
the hair still without gray. "I am 27, Falcon said to her, "and yet I now appear to be a man of nearly 50.
Holy gods. What are you doing at the Eyrie, then?
Nezrin demanded.
Do the spiders here produce the silk, too?
They are not so civilized as their sisters in the north, Hulun said, clicking her tongue. The Karen Kui do not create, only destroy. Long have they dwelled in their caves and passes of the Dagul Fells, in the far south of these mountains, and long have we maintained a respectful distance.
Why do you think they now come to steal our eggs?
Sartak glanced to the few rooks lingering at the cave mouth, waiting for their riders. He leaned forward, bracing his forearms on his thighs.
Who else?
The hearth mother countered. No poachers have been spotted. Who else might sneak upon a rook's nest so high in the world? I flew over their domain these past few days. The webs indeed have grown from the peaks and passes of the fells, down to the pine forests and the ravines, choking off all life. A glance toward Falcon. I do not believe it mere coincidence that the Karen Kui have again begun preying upon the world. At the same time, a merchant seeks out our Eyrie for answers regarding their northern kin.
Falcon raised his hands at Sartak's sharp look.
I have not sought them out, nor provoked them. I heard whispers of your hearth mother's trove of knowledge, and thought to seek her counsel before I dared anything.
What do you want with them?
Nezrin asked, angling her head.
Falcon examined his hands, flexing the fingers as if they were stiff.
I want my youth back,
Hulun said to Sartak. He sold his 100 yards, but still thinks he can reclaim the time.
I can reclaim it,
Falcon insisted, earning a warning glare from Hulun at his tone. He checked himself and clarified.
There are things that I still have left to do. I should like to accomplish them before old age interferes. I was told that slaying the spider who ate my 20 years was the only way to return those lost years to me.
Nezrin's brows narrowed. Why not go hunt that spider back home, then? Why come here?
Falcon didn't answer.
Hulun said, because he was also told that only a great warrior can slay a Karen Kui, the greatest in the land. He heard of our close proximity to the Terrors, and thought to try his luck here first, to learn what we know about the spiders. Perhaps how to kill them.
A faintly bemused look.
Perhaps also to find some backdoor way of reclaiming his years. An alternate route here, to spare him the confrontation there.
A sound enough plan, for a man insane enough to barter away his life in the first place.
What does any of this have to do with the stolen eggs and hatchlings, Edge?
Sartak, too, apparently possessed little sympathy for the merchant who'd traded his youth for kingly wealth. Falcon turned his face toward the fire, as if well aware of that.
I want you to find them, Hulun said.
They have likely already died, Edge.
Those horrors can keep their prey alive long enough in their cocoons. But you are right. They have likely already been consumed.
Rage flickered in the woman's face, a vision of the warrior beneath. The warrior her granddaughter was becoming as well.
Which is why I want you to find them the next time it happens, and remind those unholy piles of filth that we do not take kindly to theft of our young.
She jerked her chin to Falcon.
When they go, you will go too. See if the answers you seek are there.
Why not go now?
Nezrin asked.
Why not seek them out and punish them?
Because we have no proof still,
Sartak answered.
And if we attack unprovoked, The Karen Kui have long been the enemies of the Rooks, Hulan finished. They warred once, long ago, before the riders climbed up from the steps. She shook her head, chasing away the shadow of memory, and declared to Sartak, "Which is why we shall keep this quiet. The last thing we need is for riders and Rooks to fly out there in a rage, or fill this place with panic. Tell them to be on their guard at the nests, but do not say why." Sartak nodded. "As you will it, Edge." The Hearth Mother turned to Falcon. "I would have a word with my captain." Falcon understood the dismissal and rose.
"I am at your disposal, Prince Sartak."
With a graceful bow, he strode off into the hall. When Falcon's steps had faded, Hulan murmured,
"It is starting anew, isn't it?"
Those dark eyes slid to Nezrin, the fire gilding the whites.
"The one who sleeps has awoken."
"Erewhon,"
Nezrin breathed. She could have sworn the great fire banked an answer.
"You know of him, Edge?"
Sartak moved to sit on the woman's other side, allowing Nezrin to scoot closer down the stone bench. But the Hearth Mother swept her sharp stare over Nezrin.
"You have faced them, his beasts of shadow."
Nezrin clamped down on the memories that surfaced.
"I have. He's built an army of terrors on the northern continent, in Morath."
Hulan turned toward Sartak.
"Does your father know?"
"Bits and pieces. His grief."
Sartak watched the fire. Hulan placed a hand on the prince's knee.
"There was an attack in Antica, on a healer of the Tore."
Hulan swore, as filthily as her hearth son.
"We think one of Erewhon's agents might be behind it."
Sartak went on. "And rather than waste time convincing my father to listen to half-formed theories,
I remembered your tales, Edge, and thought to see if you might know anything."
"And if I told you?"
A searching, sharp look, fierce as a Rook's gaze.
"If I told you what I know of the threat, would you empty every eyrie and nest? Would you fly across the narrow sea to face them, to never return?"
Sartak's throat bobbed, and Nezrin realized that he had not come here for answers. Perhaps Sartak already knew enough about the Vog to decide for himself about how to face the threat. He had come here to win over his people, this woman. He might command the Rooks in the eyes of his father, the Empire, but in these mountains, Hulan's word was law. And in that fourth peak, on Arundin's silent slopes, her daughter Sulde stood in the wind, a woman who understood the cost of life, deeply, who might not be so eager to let her granddaughter ride with the Legion, if she allowed the Eridan Rukin to leave it all.
"If the Karen Kui are stirring, if Erewhon has risen in the north,"
Sartak said carefully,
"it is a threat for all to face."
He bowed his head.
"But I would hear what you know, Edge. What perhaps even the kingdoms in the north might have lost to time and destruction. Why it is that our people, tucked away in this land, know such stories, when the ancient demon wars never reached these shores."
Hulan surveyed them, her long, thick braids swaying. Then she braced a hand on the stone and rose, groaning.
"I must eat first and rest a while. Then I shall tell you."
She frowned toward the cave mouth, the silvery sheen of sunlight staining the walls.
"A storm is coming. I outran it on the flight back. Tell the others to prepare."
With that, the Hearth Mother strode from the warmth of the pit and into the hall beyond. Her steps were stiff, but her back was straight, a warrior's pace, clipped and unfaltering. But instead of aiming for the round table or the kitchens, Hulan entered a door that Nezrin had marked as leading into the small library.
"She is our story keeper,"
Sartak explained.
following Nezrin's attention. Being around the texts helps to tunnel into her memory. Not just a Hearthmother who knew the Rukan's history, but a sacred storykeeper. A rare gift for remembering and telling the legends and histories of the world. Sartak rose, groaning himself as he stretched.
She's never wrong about a storm. We should spread the word.
He pointed to the hall behind them.
You take the interior. I'll go to the other peaks and let them know.
Before Nezrin could ask who exactly she should approach, the prince stalked for Kadara. She frowned. Well, it would seem that she'd only have her own thoughts for company. A merchant hunting for spiders that might help him reclaim his youth, or at least learn how he might take it back from their northern kin. And the spiders themselves. Nezrin shuddered to think of those things crawling here, of all places, to feed on the most vulnerable. Monsters out of legend. Perhaps Erewhon was summoning all the dark, wicked things of this world to his banner. Rubbing her hands as if she could implant the heat of the flame into her skin, Nezrin headed into the airy proper. A storm was coming. She was to tell any who crossed her path. But she knew one was already here. The storm struck just after nightfall. Great claws of lightning ripped at the sky, and thunder shuddered through every hall and floor. Seated around the fire pit, Nezrin glanced to the distant cave mouth, where mighty curtains had been drawn across the space. They billowed and puffed in the wind, but remained anchored to the floor, parting only slightly to allow glimpses of the rain-lashed night. Just inside them, three rooks sat curled in what seemed to be nests of straw and cloth. Kadara, a fierce brown rook that Nezrin had been told belonged to Hulun, and a smaller rook with a reddish dun coloring. The tiniest rook belonged to Borte. A veritable runt, the girl had called her at dinner, even as she'd beamed with pride. Nezrin stretched out her aching legs, grateful for the heat of the fire and the blankets Sartak had dropped in her lap. She'd spent hours going up and down the airy stairs, telling whoever she encountered that Hulun had said a storm approached. Some had given her thankful nods and hurried off. Others had offered hot tea and small samplings of whatever they were cooking in their hearths. Some asked where Nezrin had come from, why she was here. And whenever she explained that she had come from Otterlin, but that her people hailed from the southern continent, their replies were all the same. Welcome home. The trek up and down the various stairs and sloped halls had taken its toll, along with the hours of training that morning. And by the time Hulun settled herself on the bench between Nezrin and Sartak, Falcon and Borte having drifted off to their own rooms after dinner, Nezrin was near nodding off. Lightning cracked outside, limning the hall with silver. For long minutes, as Hulun stared into the fire, there was only the grumble of thunder and the howl of the wind and the patter of the rain, only the crackle of the fire and rustling of Rook's wings. Stormy nights are the domain of story keepers, Hulun intoned in Halha. We can hear one approaching from 100 miles away. Smell the charge in the air like a hound on a scent. They tell us to prepare, to ready for them, to gather our kin close and listen carefully. The hair on Nezrin's arms rose beneath the warmth of her wool coat. Long ago, Hulun continued, before the Khaganate, before the horse lords on the steppes and the Tore by the sea, before any mortal ruled these lands, a rip appeared in the world, in these very mountains. Sartak's face was unreadable as his Hearthmother spoke. But Nezrin swallowed. A rip in the world. An open word gate. Here. It opened and closed swiftly. No more than a flash of lightning. As if in answer, veins of forked lightning lit the sky beyond. But that was all that was needed for the horrors to enter. The Karen Kui and other beasts of shadow. The words echoed through Nezrin. The Karen Kui,
the Stygian spiders, and other infiltrators. None of them ordinary beasts at all, but Vog.
Nezrin was grateful she was already sitting.
The Vog were here?
Her voice was too loud, too ordinary in the storm-filled silence. Sartak gave Nezrin a warning look, but Hulan only nodded, a jab of the chin.
Most of the Vog left, summoned northward when more hordes appeared there. But this place... Perhaps the Vog that arrived here were a vanguard, who assessed this land and did not find what they were seeking, so they moved out. But the Karen Kui remained in the mountain passes, servants to a dark crown. They did not leave. The spiders learned the tongues of men as they ate the fools stupid enough to venture into their barren realm. Some who made it out claimed they remained because the fells reminded them of their own blasted world. Others said the spiders lingered to guard the way back, to wait for that door to open up again, and to go home. War waged in the east, in the ancient Fey realms. 3 demon kings against a Fey queen and her armies. Demons that passed through a door between worlds, to conquer our own. And so she went on, describing the story Nezrin knew well. She let the Hearthmother narrate as her mind spun. The Stygian spiders. Actually Vog hiding in plain sight all this time. Hulan went on, and Nezrin reeled herself back together until... And yet, even when the Vog were banished to their realm, even when the final remaining demon kings slithered into the dark places of the world to hide, the Fae came here, to these mountains. They taught the Rooks to fight the Karen Kui, taught the Rooks the languages of Fae and men. They built watchtowers along these mountains, erected warning beacons throughout the land. Were they a distant guard against the Karen Kui? Or were the Fae too, like the spiders, waiting for that rip in the world to open again? By the time anyone thought to ask why, they had left those watchtowers and faded into memory. Hulan paused, and Sartak asked, Is there anything on how the Vog might be defeated, beyond mere battle? Any power to help us fight these new hordes Erewhon has built? Hulan slid her gaze to Nezrin. Ask her, she said to the prince. She already knows. Sartak barely hid his ripple of shock as he leaned forward. Nezrin breathed.
I cannot tell you, any of you. If Morath hears a whisper of it, the sliver of hope we have is gone.
The word keys. She couldn't risk saying it, even to them. You brought me down here on a fool's errand, then. Sharp, cold words.
No, Nezrin insisted. There is much we still don't know. That these spiders hail from the Vog's world. That they were part of the Vog army and have an outpost here as well as in the Rune Mountains in the northern continent. Perhaps it is tied, somehow. Perhaps there is something we have not yet learned. Some weakness amongst the Vog we might exploit.
She studied the hall, calming her thundering heart. Fear helped no one. Hulan glanced between them. Most of the Fey watchtowers are gone, but some still stand in partial ruin. The closest is perhaps half a day's flight from here. Begin there. See if anything remains. Perhaps you might find an answer or two, Nezrin Falik.
No one has ever looked?
The Fae set them with traps to keep the spiders at bay. When they abandoned the towers, they left them intact. Some tried to enter, to loot, to learn. None returned. Is it worth the risk? A cool question from a captain to the Hearthmother of his Aerie. Hulan's jaw clenched. I have told you what I can. And even this is mere scraps of knowledge that have passed beyond most memories in this land. But if the Karen Kui are stirring again, someone should go to that watchtower. Maybe you will discover something of use.
Learn how the Fae fought these terrors, how they kept them at bay. A long, assessing look at Nezrin, as thunder rattled the caves again. Perhaps it will make that sliver of hope just a bit larger.
Or get us killed, Sartak said, frowning toward the rooks half asleep in their nests.
Nothing valuable comes without a cost, boy, Hulan countered. But do not linger in the watchtower after dark.
Chapter 32
Good, said Irene. The heavy, solid weight of Kaol's leg braced against her shoulder while she slowly rotated it. Spread below her on the floor of the workroom in the physician's compound of the Torre, several days later, Kaol watched her in silence. The day was already burning enough that Irene was drenched in sweat, or would have been, if the arid climate didn't dry up the sweat before it could really soak her clothes. She could feel it, though, on her face. See it gleaming on Kaol's own, his features tight with concentration while she knelt over him.
Your legs are responding well to the training, she observed,
fingers digging into the powerful muscle of his thighs.
Irene hadn't asked what had changed, why he'd started going to the guards' courtyard at the palace. He hadn't explained either.
They are,
Kaol merely answered, scrubbing his jaw. He hadn't shaved that morning. When she'd entered his suite after he'd returned from this morning's practice with the guard, he'd said he wanted to go for a ride and to get a change in scenery for the day.
That he was so eager,
so willing to see the city, to adapt to his surroundings. Irene hadn't been able to say no. So they'd come here, after a meandering ride through Antica, to work in one of the quiet rooms down this hall. The rooms were all the same, each occupied by a desk, cot, and wall of cabinets, and each adorned with a solitary window that overlooked the neat rows of the sprawling herb garden. Indeed, despite the heat, the scents of rosemary, mint, and sage filled the chamber. Kaol grunted, as Irene lowered his left leg to the cool stone floor and started on his right. Her magic was a low thrum flowing through her and into him. Careful to avoid the black stain that slowly, so slowly, receded down his spine. They fought against it every day. The memories devoured him, fed on him, and Irene shoved back against them, chipping away at the darkness that pushed in to torment him. Sometimes, she glimpsed what he endured in that whirling black pit. The pain, the rage and guilt and sorrow. But only flickers, as if they were tendrils of smoke drifting past her. And though he did not discuss what he saw, Irene managed to push back against that dark wave. So little at a time, mere chips of stone off a boulder. But better than nothing. Closing her eyes, Irene let her powers seep into his legs like a swarm of white fireflies, finding those damaged pathways and congregating, surrounding the frayed bits that went silent during these exercises, when they should have been lit up like the rest of him.
I've been researching, she said,
opening her eyes as she rotated his leg and his hip socket.
Things ancient healers did for people with spinal injuries. There was one woman, Linquin. She was able to make a magical brace for the entire body. An invisible sort of exoskeleton that allowed the person to walk. Until they could reach a healer. Or if the healing was somehow unsuccessful.
Kaol cocked a brow.
I'm assuming you don't have one.
Irene shook her head, lowering his leg and again picking up the other to begin the next set.
Linquin only made about 10, all connected to talismans that the user could wear. They've been lost to time, along with her method of creating them. And there was another healer, Sanvi, who legend says was able to bypass the healing entirely, by planting some sort of tiny magical shard of stone in the brain.
He cringed.
I wasn't suggesting I experiment on you, she said, slapping his thigh. Or need to.
A half smile tugged on his mouth. So, how did this knowledge become lost? I thought the library here contained all your records.
Irene frowned. Both were healers working at outposts far from the Torre. There are four throughout the continent. Small centers for Torre healers to live and work. To help the people who can't make the trip here. Linquin and Sanvi were so isolated that by the time anyone remembered to fetch their records, they'd been lost. All we have now is rumor and myth.
Do you keep records? Of all this?
He gestured between them. Irene's face heated. Parts of it. Not when you're acting like a stubborn ass. Again, that smile tugged on his face. But Irene set down his leg and pulled back, though she remained kneeling on the tiles. My point, she said, steering conversation from the journals in her room levels and levels above, is that it has been done. I know it's taking us a long while, and I know you're anxious to return.
I am, but I'm not rushing you, Irene.
He sat up in a smooth movement. On the floor like this, he towered over her, the sheer size of him nearly overwhelming. He rotated his foot slowly, fighting for each movement as the muscles in the rest of his legs objected. Kaol lifted his head, meeting her stare, reading it easily.
Whoever is hunting you won't get the chance to hurt you. Whether you and I finish tomorrow or in 6 months.
I know, she breathed.
Caution and his guards hadn't caught or found traces of whoever had tried to attack her. And though it had been quiet these last few nights, she'd barely slept, even in the safety of the Torre. Only exhaustion from healing Kaol granted her any measure of reprieve. She sighed.
I think we should see Nusha again. Take another visit to the library.
His gaze turned wary. Why?
Irene frowned at the open window behind them.
The bright gardens and lavender bushes swaying in the sea breeze. The bees bobbing amongst them all.
No sign of anyone listening nearby. Because we still haven't asked how those books and scrolls wound up here.
There are no records for acquisitions dating that far back, Nusha said in Irene and Kaol's own tongue. Her mouth a tight line of disapproval as she gazed at them over her desk.
Around them, the library was a dim hive of activity, healers and assistants flowing in and out, some whispering hello to Irene and Nusha as they passed. Today, an orange-bast cat lounged by the massive hearth, her barrel eyes tracking them from her spot draped over the rolled arm of a sofa. Irene offered Nusha her best attempt at a smile.
But maybe there's some record of why those books were even needed here?
Nusha braced her dark forearms on the desk. Some people might be wary of what knowledge they're seeking if they're being hunted, which started around the time you began poking into the topic.
Kaol leaned forward in his chair, teeth flashing. Is that a threat?
Irene waved him off. Overprotective man.
I know it is dangerous and likely tied to it, but it is because of that, Nusha, that any additional information about the material here, where it came from, who acquired it could be vital.
For getting him to walk again, a dry, disbelieving statement.
Irene didn't dare glance at Kaol.
You can see that our progress is slow,
Kaol answered tightly.
Perhaps the ancients have some sort of advice for how to make it go faster.
Nusha gave them both a look that said she wasn't buying it for a minute, but sighed at the ceiling.
As I said, there are no records here dating that far back. But,
she added when Kaol opened his mouth, there are rumors that out in the desert, caves exist with such information. Caves this information came from.
Most have been lost, but there was one in the Oxara Oasis.
Nusha's look turned knowing as Irene winced.
Perhaps you should start there.
Irene chewed on her lip as they walked from the library, Kaol keeping pace beside her. When they were close to the Torre's main hallway,
to the courtyard and horse that would take him home for the evening. He asked,
"Why are you cringing?"
Irene crossed her arms, scanning the halls around them. Quiet at this time of day, right before the dinner rush.
That oasis, Oxara. It's not exactly easy to get to.
Far?
No, not that. It's owned by the royals. No one is allowed there. It's their private refuge.
Ah.
He scratched at the shadow of stubble on his jaw.
And asking to access it outright will lead to too many questions.
Exactly.
He studied her, eyes narrowing.
Don't you dare suggest I use caution, she hissed.
Kaol lifted his hands, eyes dancing.
I wouldn't dare. Though he certainly ran the moment you snapped your fingers the other night. He's a good man.
Irene braced her hands on her hips.
Why don't you invite him to a romantic interlude in the desert, then?
Kaol chuckled, trailing her as she started for the courtyard again.
I'm not versed in court intrigue, but you do have another palace connection.
Irene grimaced.
Hussar.
She toyed with a curl at the end of her hair.
She hasn't asked me to play spy recently. I'm not sure if I want to open that door again.
Perhaps you could convince her that a trip to the desert, an outing, would be fun?
You want me to manipulate her like that?
His gaze was steady.
We can find another way if you're uncomfortable.
No, it might work. It's just Hussar was born into this sort of thing. She might see right through me. And she's powerful enough that... Is it worth risking her entanglement, her anger, if we're just going on a suggestion from Nusha?
He considered her words, in a way that only Hafiza really did.
We'll think on it. With Hussar, we'll need to proceed carefully.
Irene stepped into the courtyard, motioning to one of the awaiting Tore guards that the lord needed his horse brought around from the stables.
I'm not a very good accomplice in intrigue,
she admitted to Kaol with an apologetic smile. He only brushed his hand against hers.
I find it refreshing.
And from the look in his eyes, she believed him. Enough that her cheeks heated just a bit. Irene turned toward the Tore looming over them, just to buy herself some breathing room. Looked up, up, up to where her own little window gazed toward the sea. Toward home. She lowered her gaze from the Tore to find his face grim.
I'm sorry to have brought all this upon you. All of you,
Kaol said quietly.
Don't be. Perhaps that's what it wants. To use fear and guilt to end this. Stop us.
She studied him, the proud lift of his chin, the strength he radiated in every breath.
Though, I do worry that time is not on our side.
Irene amended.
Take all the time you need to heal, yet...
She rubbed at her chest.
I have a feeling we have not seen the last of that hunter.
Kaol nodded, his jaw tight.
We'll deal with it.
And that was that. Together. They'd deal with it together.
Irene smiled slightly at him, as the light steps of his horse approached on the pale gravel.
And the thought of climbing back to her room, the thought of hours spent fretting. Maybe it made her pathetic, but Irene blurted,
Would you like to stay for dinner?
Cook will mope that you didn't say hello. She knew it was not mere fear that spurred her, knew that she just wanted to spend a few more minutes with him, talk to him in a way that she so rarely did with anyone else. For a long moment, Kaol only watched her, as if she were the only person in the world. She braced herself for the refusal, the distance, knew she should have just let him ride off into the night.
What if we ventured out for dinner instead?
You mean, in the city?
She pointed toward the open gates.
Unless you think the chair in the streets.
The walkways are even.
Her heart hammered.
Do you have any preference for what to eat?
A border. This was some strange border that they were crossing.
to leave their neutral territories and emerge into the world beyond, not as healer and patient, but woman and man.
I'll try anything,
Kaol said, and she knew he meant it. And from the way he looked to the open gates of the Torre, to the city just starting to glow beyond, she knew he wanted to try anything, was as eager for a distraction from that shadow looming over them as she herself was. So Irene signaled to the guards that they didn't need his horse. Not for a while yet.
I know just the place.
Some people stared. Some were too busy going about their business or journeys home to remark on Kaol, as he wheeled his chair alongside Irene. She had to step in only a few times, to help him over the bump of a curve or down one of the steep streets. She led him to a place 5 blocks away, the establishment like nothing he'd seen in Rifthold. He'd visited a few private dining rooms with Dorian, yes, but those had been for the elite, for members and their guests. This place, it was akin to those private clubs, in that it was only for eating, full of tables and carved wooden chairs. But this was open to anyone, like the public rooms at an inn or tavern. The front of the pale-stoned building had several sets of doors that were open to the night, leading out onto a patio full of more tables and chairs under the stars. The space jutting into the street itself, so that diners could watch the passing city bustle, even glimpse down the sloping street to the dark sea sparkling under the moonlight. And the enticing smells coming from within. Garlic, something tangy, something smoky. Irene murmured to the woman who came to greet them, which must have amounted to a table for two and without one chair, because within a moment he was being led to the street patio, where a servant discreetly removed one of the chairs at a small table for him to pull up to the edge. Irene claimed a seat opposite him, more than a few heads turning their way, not to gawk at him, but her, the Torre healer. She didn't seem to notice. The servant returned to rattle off what had to be the menu, and Irene ordered in her halting Halha. She bit her lower lip, glancing to the table, the public dining room.
Is this all right?
Kaol took in the open sky above them, the color bleeding to a sapphire blue, the stars beginning to blink awake. When had he last relaxed? Eaten a meal not to keep his body healthy and alive, but to enjoy it. He grappled for the words, grappled to settle into the ease.
I've never done anything like this,
he at last admitted. His birthday this past winter, in that greenhouse. Even then, with Aelin, he'd been half there, half focused on the palace he'd left behind, on remembering who was in charge and where Dorian was supposed to be. But now... What? Eaten a meal?
Had a meal when I was just... Kaol.
He wasn't sure if he'd explained it right, if he could articulate it. Irene angled her head, her massive hair sliding over a shoulder.
Why?
Because I was either a lord's son and heir, or captain of the guard, or now hand to the king.
Her gaze was unflinching as he fumbled to explain.
No one recognizes me here. No one has even heard of Aniel, and it's...
Liberating?
Refreshing,
he countered, giving Irene a small smile at the echo to his earlier words. She blushed prettily in the golden light from the lanterns within the dining room behind them.
Well, good.
And you? Do you go out with friends often? Leave the healer behind?
Irene watched the people streaming by.
I don't have many friends,
she admitted. Not because I don't want them, she blurted, and he smiled.
I just... At the Torre, we're all busy. Sometimes a few of us will go for a meal or drink, but our schedules rarely align. And it's easier to eat at the mess hall, so we're not really a lively bunch. Which was why Kashan and Hasar became my friends. When they're in Antica. But I've never really had the chance to do much of this.
He almost asked, go out to dinner with men, but said, you had your focus elsewhere.
She nodded,
And maybe one day, maybe I'll have the time to go out and enjoy myself, but there are people who need my help. It feels selfish to take time for myself, even now.
You shouldn't feel that way.
And you're any better. Kaol chuckled, leaning back as the servant came, bearing a pitcher of chilled mint tea. He waited until the man left before saying,
Maybe you and I will have to learn how to live, if we survive this war.
It was a sharp, cold knife between them. But Irene straightened her shoulders, her smile small and yet defiant, as she lifted her pewter glass of tea. To living, Lord Kaol. He clinked his glass against hers.
To being Kaol and Irene, even just for a night.
Kaol ate until he could barely move, the spices like small revelations with every bite. They talked as they dined, Irene explaining her initial months at the Torre and how demanding her training had been. Then she'd asked about his training as captain, and he'd balked at talking of Brullo and the others. And yet, he couldn't refuse her joy, her curiosity. And somehow, talking about Brullo, the man who had been a better father to him than his own, it did not hurt, not as much. A lower, quieter ache, but one he could withstand. One he was glad to weather, if it meant honoring a good man's legacy by telling his story. So they talked and ate, and when they finished, he escorted her to the glowing white walls of the Torre. Irene herself seemed glowing, as she smiled when they stopped within the gates while his horse was readied. Thank you, she said, her cheeks flushed and gleaming. For the meal and company.
It was my pleasure,
Kaol said, and meant it. I'll see you tomorrow morning at the palace? An unnecessary question, but he nodded. Irene shifted from one foot to another, still smiling, still shining, as if she were the last vibrant ray of the sun, staining the sky long after it had vanished over the horizon. What? She asked, and he realized he'd been staring.
Thank you for tonight,
Kaol said, stifling what tried to leap off his tongue.
I can't take my eyes off you.
She bit her lip again, the crunch of hooves on gravel approaching. Good night, she murmured, and took a step away. Kaol reached out, just to brush his fingers over hers. Irene paused, her fingers curling, as if they were the petals of some shy flower.
Good night,
he merely said. And as Kaol rode back to the illuminated palace across the city, he could have sworn that some weight in his chest, on his shoulders, had vanished, as if he'd lived with it his entire life unaware. And now, even with all that gathered around him, around Otterlin and those he cared for, how strange it felt, that lightness. Chapter 33 The watchtower of Edelun jutted up from the mist-shrouded pines like the shard of a broken sword. It had been situated atop a low-lying peak that overlooked a solid wall of gargantuan mountains, and as Nezrin and Sartak swept near the tower, sailing along the tree-crusted hills, she had the sense of racing toward a tidal wave of hard stone. For a heartbeat, a wave of lethal glass swept for her instead. She blinked, and it was gone.
There,
Sartak whispered, as if fearful that any might hear, while he pointed toward the enormous mountains lurking beyond.
Over that lip? That is the start of Karen Kui territory. The Dagul Fells. Those in the watchtower would have been able to see anyone coming down from those mountains, especially with their Feysight.
Feysight or not, Nezrin scanned the barren slopes of the fells, a wall of boulders and shards of rock. No trees, no streams. As if life had fled. Ulan flew over that?
Believe me, Sartak grumbled, I am not pleased. Borte
got an earful about it this morning. I'm surprised your kneecaps still function.
Didn't you notice my limp earlier?
Despite the nearing watchtower, despite the wall of mountain that rose up beyond it. Nezrin chuckled. She could have sworn Sartak leaned closer, his broad chest pushing into the quivering bow she had strapped across her back, along with the twin long knives courtesy of Borte. They hadn't told anyone where they were going or what they sought, which had earned no shortage of glares from Borte over breakfast, and curious glances from Falcon across the round table. But they had agreed last night, when Sartak left Nezrin at her bedroom door, that secrecy was vital, for now. So they'd departed an hour after dawn, armed and bearing a few packs of supplies. Even though they planned to be headed home well before sunset, Nezrin had insisted on bringing their gear. Should the worst happen? Should anything happen? It was better to be prepared. Borte, despite her ire at being left in the dark, had braided Nezrin's hair after breakfast, a tight, elegant plait starting at the crown of her head and landing just where her cape fell to cover her flying leathers. The braid was tight enough that Nezrin had avoided the urge to loosen it these hours that they'd flown. But now that the tower was in sight and her hair had barely shifted, Nezrin supposed the braid could stay. Kadara circled the watchtower twice, dropping lower with each pass.
No signs of webs, Nezrin observed.
The upper levels of the watchtower had been destroyed by weather or some long-ago passing army, leaving only two floors above the ground. Both were exposed to the elements, the winding stairwell in the center coated in pine needles and dirt. Broken beams and blocks of stone also littered it, but no indications of life, or any sort of miraculously preserved library. With Kadara's size, the Rook had to find a clearing nearby to land, since Sartak didn't trust the watchtower walls to hold her. The bird leaped into the air as soon as they'd begun the climb up the small incline to the watchtower proper. She'd circle overhead until Sartak whistled for her, apparently. Another trick of the Rookin and the Dargon on the steps. The whistling, along with their whistling arrows. They had long allowed both peoples to communicate in a way that few noticed or bothered to comprehend, passing messages through enemy territory or down army lines. The riders had trained the Rooks to understand the whistles, too, to know a call for help from a warning to flee. Nezrin prayed with each grueling step through the thick pine trees and granite boulders that they would only need the whistle to summon the bird. She was no great tracker, but Sartak, it seemed, was deftly reading the signs around them. A shake of the prince's head told Nezrin enough. No hint of a presence, arachnid or otherwise. She tried not to look too relieved. Despite the tall trees, the fells were a solid, looming presence to her right, drawing the eye even as it repelled every instinct. Blocks of stone greeted them first. Great rectangular chunks, half buried in the pine needles and soil. The full weight of summer lay upon the land, yet the air was cool, the shade beneath the trees outright chilly.
I don't blame them for abandoning it if it's this cold in the summer, Nezrin muttered. Imagine it in winter.
Sartak smiled, but pressed a finger to his lips as they cleared the last of the trees. Blushing that he'd needed to remind her, Nezrin unslung her bow and knocked an arrow, letting it hang limply while they tipped back their heads to take in the tower.
It must have been enormous, thousands of years ago, if the ruins were enough to make her feel small.
Any barracks or living quarters had long since tumbled away or rotted, but the stone archway into the tower itself remained intact, flanked by twin statues of some sort of weather-worn bird. Sartak approached, his long knife gleaming like quicksilver in the watery light, as he studied the statues.
Rooks?
The question was a mere breath. Nezrin squinted.
No. Look at the face. The beak. They're owls.
Tall, slender owls, their wings tucked in tight. The symbol of Silba, of the Tore. Sartak's throat bobbed.
Let's be swift. I don't think it's wise to linger.
Nezrin nodded, one eye behind them as they slipped through the open archway.
It was a familiar position, the rear guard. In Rifthold sewers, she'd often let Kaol stalk ahead while she covered behind. Arrow aimed into the darkness at their backs. So her body acted on pure muscle memory. While Sartak took the first steps through the archway, and she twisted back, arrow aimed at the pine forest, scanning the trees. Nothing. Not a bird or rustle of wind through the pines. She turned a heartbeat later, assessing efficiently, as she had always done, even before her training. Marking exits, pitfalls, possible sanctuaries. But there wasn't much to note in the ruin. The tower floor was well lit thanks to the vanished ceiling above. The crumbling staircase leading into the gray sky. Slits in the stone revealed where archers might have once positioned themselves, or watched from within the warmth of a tower on a freezing day. Nothing up, Nezrin observed perhaps a bit uselessly. Facing Sartak, just as he took a step toward an open archway leading down into a dark stairwell, she grabbed his elbow. Don't. He gave her an incredulous look over his shoulder. Nezrin kept her own face like stone. Your edge said these towers were laid with traps. Just because we have yet to see one does not mean they are not still here. She pointed with her arrow toward the open archway to the levels below ground. We keep quiet. Tread carefully. I go first. To hell with being the rear guard if he was prone to plunging into danger. The prince's eyes flared, but she didn't let him object. I faced some of the horrors of Morath this spring and summer. I know how to mark them, and where to strike. Sartak looked her over again. You really should have been promoted. Nezrin smiled, releasing his muscled bicep, wincing as she realized the liberties she'd taken by grabbing him, touching a prince without permission. Two captains, remember? He said, noting the cringe she failed to hide. Indeed. Nezrin inclined her head and stepped in front of him, and into the archway of the stairs leading below. Her arm strained as she pulled the bowstring taut, scanning the darkness immediately beyond the stairwell entrance. When nothing leaped out, she slackened the bow, placed her arrow back in the quiver, and plucked up a handful of rocks from the ground, shards and chips from the felled blocks of stone around them. A step behind, Sartak did the same, filling his pockets with them. Listening carefully, Nezrin rolled one of the rocks down the spiral stairs, letting it bounce and crack, and a faint click, and Nezrin hurled herself back, slamming into Sartak and sending them both sprawling to the ground. A thud sounded within the stairwell below. Then another. In the quiet that followed, her heavy breathing the only sound, she listened again. Hidden bolts, she observed, wincing as she found Sartak's face mere inches away. His eyes were upon the stairwell, even as he kept a hand on her back, the other angling his long knife toward the archway. Seems I owe you my life, Captain, Sartak said, and Nezrin quickly peeled back, offering a hand to help him rise. He clasped it, his hand warm around hers, as she hauled him to his feet. Don't worry, Nezrin said dryly. I won't tell Borte. She plucked up another handful of rocks and sent them rolling and scattering down the gloom of the stairs. A few more clicks and thumps, then silence. We go slow, she said, all amusement fading, and didn't wait for his nod as she prodded the first step down with the tip of her bow. She tapped and pushed along the stair, watching the walls, the ceiling. Nothing. She did it to the second, third, and fourth steps, as far as her bow could reach. And only when she was satisfied that no surprises waited did she allow them to step onto the stairs. Nezrin repeated it with the next four steps, finding nothing. But when they reached the first turn of the spiral stairs, I really owe you my life, Sartak breathed, as they beheld what had been fired from a slit in the wall at the ninth step. Barbed iron spikes, designed to slam into flesh and stay there, unless the victim wanted to rip out more of their skin or organs on the curved, vicious hooks on the way out. The spike had been fired so hard that it had sunk deep into the mortar between the stones.
"Remember that these traps were not for human assailants," she breathed.
"But for spiders..."